Thank you. I want to acknowledge my colleagues, Ginny Sprang, Candace Jackson, Miriam Silman, and Scott LaJoy, and Phyllis Lee, who is sitting right there as the project director of this work. I don't have any personal financial connections here to declare, but I do want to mention that the center has been funded by the Kentucky Critical Infrastructure Protection Program, which is managed by National Institute for Hometown Security, which is a branch of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And the reason why this is of interest to Homeland Security is the fact that one of the top three national security threats that Homeland Security is estimating over the next 15 to 20 years is the recurrence of H5N1 pandemic virus. And so they have devoted a fair amount of funding over the last few years to look at how the United States populace would respond and ways of managing the preparing and managing response to pandemic influenza. Part of what our research has been, and I'm going to talk about the project, but to just begin, there are certain principles of public health ethics that have guided us in terms of trying to understand the ethical implications of our empirical research. And I'm just going to show two brief examples that are not child-specific, but they are public health-specific. From the Public Health Leadership Society, there is a lot of respect for the rights of individuals and community. There is an emphasis on the opportunity for input for community members for public health policy and measures, the empowerment of disenfranchised community members, and that communities should be provided information that's needed for decisions on policies or programs and should obtain community consent for implementation. Along with that is there needs to be, for policies and programs, respect for diverse values, beliefs, and cultures in the community, and that all approaches should attempt to develop collaborations and affiliations that will enhance the public's trust. If you take another example of some the impressive output of ethical deliberation, Ross Upshur's group, post-SARS, in Canada, developed a document called Stand on Guard for Thee, where that commission looked at a set of 10 substantive values that ought to be considered and 5 procedural values in terms of managing public health emergencies. And this was developed kind of looking at the lessons learned from the SARS epidemic 2003. Procedure values that I really want to highlight are the decisions, public health decisions, ought to be reasonable, that is, they should be evidence-based, open and transparent, inclusive, responsive, and accountable. So these were the kinds of values and the kinds of ethical standards that we were looking at as we began our empirical work to try to look at ethical dimensions in our study of pandemic and response to pandemic. Our study from the center began with an assumption that there were probably unintended policy effects from the kinds of quarantine and isolation that have at least been proposed and in some cases statutorily approved and passed into law, that there's an emotional and human side to the impacts of quarantine and isolation on families and children, or in other words, behavioral health impacts that probably have not been sufficiently thought about. And that these strategies that do disease containment through quarantine and isolation and perhaps some other forms of social distancing might create unanticipated and additional problems. So what we attempted to do was to systematically investigate the biopsychosocial effects of quarantine and isolation as a way of thinking about some best practice approaches for disease containment approaches that would also take into account the biopsychosocial needs of children and families. And we targeted a wide group of people to interview and to survey, and we also looked at about 1,000 different public health documents, including the review of the 50 state plans specifically designed for pandemic response. And the end product, which we're in the process of designing now, is the best practice guidelines and educational programming that will be online and available to public health and other professionals. Basically, this study ended up collecting data from over 2,600 people in different types of categories over a number of six U.S. states. And what we did was we took a look at when we were about to begin the study, the empirical part of the study, H1N1 broke out. So we were able to see kind of a little, an aversion of how different states would respond to a pandemic. So we had five states where there were high rates of pediatric mortality, and then we also studied Kentucky as well. We looked at three locations in Mexico, especially with emphasis on the fact that Mexico was seen as the genesis of North American H1N1. And we also studied Toronto, Ontario, in that we looked at the SARS epidemic and then the subsequent impact of H1N1 after some of the measures that had been developed in response to the SARS pandemic. In the part of the study that really focused on law and ethics, we used not only a wide range of documents and literature review, but then also public policy and public health documents. But we also looked at key informants and in terms of individual interviews with experts, small group focus groups, large group focus groups, and we looked at them from a variety of different kinds of backgrounds. Four themes. We have very limited time. There were multiple studies, 60 or 70 major interesting findings. I've tried to reduce them to four major themes. One is that even though we know that 344 children died from laboratory-confirmed H1N1 or associated illness, and this was four times the annual pediatric death rate, we know that children, even though they are victims and vectors of pandemic flu, that most preparedness planning that existed at the time of our study, which has been ongoing, did not design response strategies tailored for young people and their caregivers. And family-centered care approaches were rarely emphasized in preparedness planning. So it was very interesting that although children play an enormous role as victims and vectors of pandemic virus, that there was very little specialized attention to them and to their families. The second major theme was that almost all the state planning was top-down. It was basically pulling together public officials, public health, but also other officials to develop preparedness planning. So it generally did not really attend to underserved and high-risk populations in the design and implementation of pandemic response. And there were a few practical provisions made for vulnerable and low socioeconomic status populations. So in cases where widespread quarantine and isolation and other social containment strategies were being recommended and would be implemented at the state level, for many poor people, for example, whose children depend on perhaps school breakfast and school lunch, there were no practical considerations of if there were massive long-range school closings, how replacement would occur for those meals. Also, for working families who were quarantined, wage earners, maybe even day laborers or people who are living from paycheck to paycheck, how that income would be replaced. The Canadians, by the way, and the Mexicans in their pandemics mandated it through the government that there be income replacements. We also found that our concern that there would be stressed responses as a result of quarantine and isolation was well-founded. We found that children who were quarantined or isolated during H1N1 suffered PTSD at rates similar to those who survived other major natural disasters, and we used parental measures to look at PTSD both in children and in parents. And children and their parents were disproportionately suffering from PTSD. And we also found that there were higher rates of secondary traumatic stress among professionals serving folks during pandemic virus. And there were certainly long-term effects, for example, from nurses and other healthcare professionals who were serving during the SARS epidemic in Toronto. So these were not short-term responses. However, there aren't very many, if any, behavioral health responses in place in public health care measures, either at the state level or in many of the documents associated with pandemic response. This is going to be problematic. And third, that there is an impressive level of preparedness and response work, but there aren't people actively working to build resilient response systems at this point between pandemic events. That is, we do have a core group of people who are interested, like ourselves and other people around the country, who are interested in pandemic influenza response and are working on this. But in terms of being embedded throughout the public health system, there is rapid turnover and exit of informed and committed professionals. Once they get trained up in pandemic response, they're often lost to the system. And this is exacerbated by the fact that everyday people from communities, including community leaders, were generally not consulted or involved in developing these pandemic response. So we see kind of a de facto Swiss cheese response. I'm just going to suggest a couple of remedies that are ethically informed. The fact is that we've got a lot of very strong public health law in place that could be implemented in H5N1 or similarly lethal pandemic. Yet there's very little public health powers will be used in a manner that would protect vulnerable populations, especially children. We see the fact that there is a lot of room at the local level for these types of discussions and the ethical responsibility for including everyday people and also the perspectives of children and adolescents in pandemic response. We need to see the recruitment and involvement of a more diverse pool of participants for greater diversity of perspectives and approaches as states begin at the state level to add addenda, and we are recommending specifically behavioral health addenda to state preparedness plans. And we are also seeing the fact that even though states, through various federal funding, are trying to tailor their laws for pandemic response, right now there is an emphasis on compliance and public compliance with public health law, and some inadvertent measures being recommended that may actually create survival activities like going to work and especially for low SES to actually end up breaking the law and subject to arrest and adjudication. So we recommend that we should be thinking about the daily plight of non-majority and low SES populations so survival behaviors are not criminalized. And finally, we see that there is another ethical obligation to use evidence-based practices in response, and that there are very few, if any, evidence-based behavioral health care responses in place in pandemic preparedness. But fortunately, there is a great deal of literature right now for screening assessment interventions that could be effective for the prevention and treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and acute stress, traumatic stress disorder, and that preparedness planning ought to be using evidence-based approaches and be thinking about child and adolescent-specific approaches within the context of family relationships. So finally, the last recommendation is ethical reasoning, and ethical thinking is a very, very complex endeavor, and especially under these kinds of conditions, and that more widespread training of ethical decision-making and reasoning ought to be made a component of other types of decision-making and problem-solving and integrated into those kinds of decision-making approaches. So I'll stop.